Welcome back to the Unschool Files podcast. I'm your host, Megan, and you are listening to episode 35. I've been away for a while. I've been doing life, international moving and settling. I've also been working on other projects like putting together a Discord server that is bringing a bunch of unschooling families together from all around the world, and also really, really focused on the Unschool Files zine. We're three issues in, and issue four is due out this winter, which I'm very excited about. This project has been such a passion, and I'm thrilled to be bringing it to anyone who's interested in learning more about unschooling or seeing what unschoolers are up to. We are displaying art and photography and writing, poetry, recipes, I mean, just dynamic things from unschoolers. It also features community resources and shares a little bit more about what unschooling is like and why people choose to unschool. So if you're interested in learning more about the Unschool Files zine, you can head over to my website, theunschoolfiles.com, where you can purchase a copy to have it delivered to your home, or you can actually purchase a digital copy and view it from the comfort of your home without having to receive mail, or you can click download and print it yourself. So I'm really, really excited to share that with you. In this episode, you're gonna hear from a grown unschooler who was unschooled in the 90s and who's now working in academia. We discuss her childhood in Canada, a bit about her family life and their reasons for not attending conventional schooling, and her path to higher education. So join me in welcoming Alexis Dayton McIntyre to the podcast. Hi, Alexis. Welcome to the podcast. I am so excited to have you here.
Thank you.
Why don't you get us started off by telling the listeners a little bit about yourself and your relationship to unschooling?
Sure. So my name is Alexis Dayton McIntyre, and I am currently a research scientist at University of Cambridge in the UK, but I grew up in Canada on the traditional territory of the Nanaimo First Nation, and I unschooled. So my mom never put us in school. She was pretty committed to the unschooling way from the beginning. So I grew up in the 90s unschooling. And up until my teen years, that was just what we did. I did do some formal high school classes, but that was with correspondence courses. Mm-hmm. So I've never really been in school and up until university.
Oh, so the 90s was a time where that like wasn't a very popular thing, right?
Yeah. So the thing about Canadian distances, especially now that I live in Europe, where things are so close together, my sort of group of unschoolers, we were spread out all over Vancouver Island. So if we wanted to get together to hang out with other kids, that would mean that my mom would have to drive for like 40 minutes or an hour or something down the highway just so that we could have a play date. I hope it's better now. I hope that it's, you don't have to drive down the highway to play with other kids as homeschoolers. But yeah, that was what it was in the 90s.
So on the other end of that, your schooled peers, what was like, was it far away for your schooled peers to get to their schools as well? Or were there local schools in like the rural areas that they could get to easily?
There were schools around, and I mean, the city that I lived in, I don't know what the population is now, but it's like under 100,000 people, but it wasn't, I wouldn't describe the city itself as particularly rural. I should also say too that I did participate in some activities where I could make friends with people who were in school. So okay. For example, I did Girl Guides for a couple of years, which is like Girl Scouts in Canada. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of like music as well. So I had the opportunity to make some friends who were in school as well.
Okay, but you're just talking about traveling far distances for just people who were also not attending school.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. We had a group that encompassed basically most of Vancouver Island. And if the parents wanted to organize something kind of like the unschooler version of a field trip. So visit a museum or go to the pool together, then that would be like a pretty big geographical area of people who were included in that.
How often was that happening for you all?
That's a great question. It's a pretty solid presence in my childhood memories, but I don't know how far I want to trust that. I would say not probably every month, but at least like every couple of months we'd have like a big gathering like that.
Okay. So it sounds like even if they weren't, you know, weekly or biweekly or monthly, that they were still pretty impactful since it's a big presence in your mind.
Yes. Yeah. I really looked forward to them. I mean, it's so important to hang out with other kids. And we didn't really live in, although we lived in a city, there weren't a ton of kids in my neighborhood. So it meant a lot to me.
Yeah. What was your family's reason or your mother's reason for not sending you to school?
So I think she had a really negative experience. My mom had a really negative experience of school herself. When she would tell us about it, she said that she spent a lot of time basically locked in a broom cupboard, is how she put it.
Oh my goodness.
I would say like my theory is that my mom is kind of textbook undiagnosed adult with ADHD, which is really common for a lot of women in particular. Mm. And I think that the sort of conventional sit in your desk, pay attention, stop talking, stop fidgeting, all of that was just really tough for her as a small child. And her parents are immigrants, so I'm not sure how much they could or wanted to necessarily advocate for her in the Canadian school system. Mm-hmm. So yeah, she just had a really difficult time. And I think she grew up feeling like she was stupid or that there was something wrong with her. And later on, she did go to university and did well and everything. And I think that she really started to feel like maybe the problem isn't me. Maybe the problem is this really oppressive schooling system.
Yeah.
So I think she did a lot of her own research. And she was also really into breastfeeding. So she joined La Leche League. Mm-hmm. And I think that she probably was exposed to ideas about homeschooling and maybe unschooling through that organization as well. So by the time we were school age, my brother and me, like she was already really on board. I have to say my dad was not. And I think that was really difficult for them, actually. I mean, it's not something like it's all water under the bridge at this point, right? Now that I'm in my 30s. But I think that I would say like it happened. He didn't insist that we go to school, but I think that was always a bit of a contentious issue for them because his experience was not like my mom's experience.
Yeah.
My dad did really well in school, and I think he looked back at his memories of school and high school with a lot of nostalgia. Mm. I think he worried that we were missing out on something.
Yeah. You know, I think you are speaking to something that so many families are experiencing. And it's not always the dad who's not on board, but more often than not in the families that I have spoken to, it usually is, but I don't want to make the assumption that it always is. But I wonder if you could speak to that a little more on how those conversations went as a family. Like, were you included in these conversations, or was it just like a point of contention between the two of them a little more privately? And how did your mom sort of field that experience?
Well, I don't want to speak for either of them now, but I would say that it was definitely a very emotionally charged topic. And I should say too that, like, I mean, my parents are together still. They overcame their different opinions on unschooling. But it was very, I think it could get really heated. I should also say too that my brother has learning disabilities. And in some ways, I think that for my father, he felt like because my brother was homeschooling, that this was somehow perhaps making it worse. It's really complicated as well, because learning disabilities, especially again in the 90s, were not well understood.
Right.
And I mean, obviously, like my brother and I both grew up in the same household with the same parents and the same mom who unschooled us. And I took to school very quickly when I did end up doing some formal schooling. And I don't know what that would, like, I haven't had a conversation with my dad really as an adult to say, like, well, I didn't miss out on something having homeschooled,
right.
That is keeping me back now, since I now work in academia.
Right.
But again, like, I think it's hard to, like, judging my parents' actions on, or their opinions on homeschooling now from the vantage point of 2022, it's hard for me to, like, it was, like you mentioned earlier, it was pretty outrageous to do that.
Yeah.
So I don't, although I disagree with my dad in terms of how opposed he could feel to it, I can also say that, I mean, I think it was coming from a place of wanting the best for his kids. Like, it wasn't coming from anything other than that, for sure.
Yeah. I always like to say, like, multiple things are true at the same time. Like, it was both, in this case, it was both good for you, and perhaps good for your brother. I don't want to speak for his situation either, but also at the same time, his concerns were rooted in something real and raw for him as well. Like, they could both be true at the same time.
I think that's such a good point, and probably, yeah, it's a good way of looking at these things in general, because I think in some ways, for the same reason that the school system was really bad for my mom, I think that it would have been really bad for my brother. But on the other hand, I think that some of his learning disability could have, like, he could have gotten maybe more accommodation, for example. He lives at home still, and he probably will be, and it's difficult for him to I think it's been really difficult for him in some ways to integrate into society as an adult with his learning disabilities without having gone through the apparatus of the public school system, where there might have been somebody who picked up on it and then he could have gotten various accommodations or help in some way. I'm not advocating that everybody needs that, or that an intervention or medication or anything like that is right for everybody. But I think that, yeah, that's one of the challenges, I think, of homeschooling, is that in some ways, even if your intention is not to be isolationist, that's kind of can sometimes be what happens, because we just don't necessarily have we're trying to avoid the negative aspects of the institution, but there are some things about the institution which can be helpful or can connect us to the help we need. So, yeah.
I think it's really important to speak to that. I think there's, I know there is, because I've spoken to many families who experienced this, where some kids are home and some kids are in school because the school system, their local system, is able to provide resources and access to different sorts of programs, therapists, specialists that they wouldn't be able to get in any other way.
Exactly.
I think it's really important to speak to that, because sometimes we can, and I'm speaking in the proverbial we, I think sometimes we can go really hard and fast for something that we really believe in, and maybe cling to an ideology or a practice, even if it may not be the best for that individual.
Yes. Yeah. And it would be wonderful, I think, if we were able to live in a world where we could have more of those services and resources that were just more readily available, because part of the problem is, for at least in my brother's case, is him aging out of the system, even in a very rich country like Canada that has maybe overall it tends towards more progressive like welfare and the sort of social net. But even then, as somebody who is over the age of 18, he doesn't have access to these kinds of resources anymore. Right. So yeah, so part of it is just the way that it's not really the way that these things are bundled up with the school system, and that you have to kind of buy into the school system to buy into these basic services as well. It's a shame.
It is. I really wish that even outside of the school system, that just communities in general were more equipped with different community services that weren't necessarily tied to the school system. Even as much as like, I know certain places may have like YMCA or local community centers that have sports and things like that. But the school system really, really serves as like a neighborhood or a community center or hub for community, for friendships, for organized sports, or to play music with other people. And I really think those things should be accessible in a community without having to attend school, which would maybe have given, you know, your mother the opportunity to provide those services for him through the community without having to attend school.
Totally. And also for the people who do attend school, but maybe stuff is going on in their lives when they're in that age. Like there are so many people where like the idea of sort of aging out the way that like kids in the foster care system age out. And then it's suddenly like, okay, you're on your own now. Like I think a lot of people would benefit from this kind of extended social care.
Absolutely. I guess back to the original question about how your mom fielded that. I was thinking in my mind as I was saying that, which you wouldn't know because it was in my mind, but I was thinking, I think a lot of mothers tend to sort of want to cram at that point when the other parent gets concerned, right? Or they're feeling like, oh, they're probably missing out, or oh, they're not learning enough, or they don't know these things that are really important and they're going to need these life skills, et cetera, et cetera. I think the parent who tends to be home, which is usually the mother in most cases, tends to want to try to find ways to prove to their partner that their children are learning and that they are well-equipped or on their way to being well-equipped to deal with whatever the challenges are that the other parent is struggling to understand how they're going to meet that moment, you know?
Yeah.
And I wondered if there was any examples of that in your family or if that didn't really occur for you.
I think that this is to go back to the complexity, the way multiple things can be true. I think it's tricky in my family's case. I think because I took to reading and writing and the sort of skills or interests that are really favored by the public school system. And because things were really difficult for my brother and because he had developmental delays, it's very fraught, I would say. I think that sort of this is a great question. It's a conversation I've never had with I've never thought to really have this conversation with my parents as an adult. But I think that it would have been difficult in a way because it's sort of almost like I think because like my brother and I are also very close in age. I'm just over a year older than he is. So I feel almost like if she had been trying to say, look, the kids are doing fine, in order for her to do that, I think in some ways she would have had to have played into the sort of rules and the value system imposed by a public school system. And in a way that would privilege me because I had the right personality and the right interests to sort of fit that mold when I needed to and when it would work for me.
Yeah. So what were those interests? I'm curious.
Yeah, we did all sorts of stuff. So in my province of British Columbia, we had this very kind of forward-thinking, a homeschooler-friendly program that was offered by a school district that was nowhere close to where we lived. It was like on the other side of the province, which is really far away in Canadian distances. It was like this tiny school district that started this long distance learning program. Mm-hmm. And so they sent us a desktop computer that had Windows 95 on it. And so I had a desktop computer when I was like 6 years old.
Very cool.
Yeah, it was a great program. And they would send us CD-ROMs that had all the best educational games on them. So we played a lot of educational games, like various, your Yukon Trail and Oregon Trail, yeah. Amazon Trail, all of that. But I also, I was really interested in designing things on the computer. I also started to learn HTML and making websites. I don't know what, I can't remember what the topic of these websites, like I cannot even, I feel like it would be deeply embarrassing if I went and found my like 8, 9, 10 year old websites. But yeah, so I really took to computers basically.
Okay.
And we went to the library a lot. So I loved to read, and we went to the library like every week basically. And I would just take out stacks of books. My brother had really, really specific and diverse, but interest that I think you could kind of see a recurring theme where he also really liked design. But he has really, really specific, narrow, obsessive interests. So he would become obsessed with things like the design on antique tins. Mm. He had an antique tin collection. He also became really interested in the labels on fireworks, like the kind of fireworks you buy around Halloween, mm. that kind of a thing. So he had a lot of interests in things like that. And basically we did a lot of reading, exploring outside, because we were lucky to live in a place with beautiful nature that was really close by. We were definitely very much self-directed, and yeah. I think my mom saw her role as like a facilitator of that. So if we needed to look something up, she'd take us to the library. Again, we had the computer at home, which was a real privilege for the time.
Yeah. So it sounds like she didn't place a value on specific interests or really want for certain things to happen, but you naturally gravitated towards things that were sort of looked at as acceptable ways to spend your time, quote unquote, educational.
Yeah, I think that her attitude was that whatever we ended up becoming interested in, it would naturally lend itself to transferable skills. Like, I don't think that was her goal per se, but I think that everything, like, for example, I had my astronomy solar system phase, as many kids do, and I used the desktop computer to find images of the planets, and I compiled like a report, and because we had the computer, I could do sort of like a fancy report on Microsoft Word. And although I was interested in planets, what I was doing was I was working on my research skills, I was working on my writing, I was learning how to use word processors, that kind of a thing. And even if with my brother and his very, very specific interests, because he was interested in fireworks, he was learning about chemistry and the history, the cultural history of fireworks. So all of these things, like, I think if you're genuinely curiosity driven and you have the good fortune to be able to access the library or the internet, such as it was in those days, then your interests will take you all over the place anyways, because that's how knowledge works, right? Like, it's not in little boxes or modules that you learn in a curriculum.
Yeah. Did your mother have to tell you like how to compile things or ask you to do that? Or did you do that because you you just wanted to do that.
She definitely did not impose any kind of structure or goalposts for us.
Yeah.
It just sort of, I think that it just, it's just the sort of, it's, it'll happen naturally.
Yeah. Well, I think when you're surrounded by materials and, like you said, access to things to, that you can use to take your curiosity a little bit further, even if you're not surrounded by full bookshelves at home, but you get enough trips to the library and that's just your life, I think maybe it just kind of, it just naturally happens.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. I think I also reflect on, I mean, I don't know what it would be like if you had, like, my family was certainly not super well off, but my dad was early in his career as a professional, and my mom had the economic security to be a stay-at-home mom, and both my parents went to university, so there is certainly a lot of privilege in that. And it's something that I think about too, especially again because I live in the UK, where not only they not only have public schooling here, obviously, but they have private schools, and that is a huge thing here. They have very much a multi-tiered system, and people will spend thousands and thousands of pounds per year to send their kids to what they think of is like the best private school, because they think, well, this is going to give my child the best chance in life. But my feeling when I hear about this as an observer who lives here is just, you know what, you are university educated people with like lots of nice books and things, and you go to the museum and whatever, all the things that are sort of associated with affluence, basically. Mm-hmm. Like your kids are going to be fine, like, right. It's not because of the school, it's because of intergenerational wealth.
Yes. Thank you for speaking to that.
it's very, very I think that if you want to see it in practice, the UK is the place to do that.
Yeah. Did you ever feel frustrated with your life being so much different than your peers? Or would you say that you were so wrapped up in your curiosity and it sounds like you had a very busy mind as a young person?
I think when I was younger, I was really glad that I homeschooled. So up until I was probably 10 or 11, the idea of being away from my mom for 6 hours a day and sitting in the classroom. And then also, I mean, my mom definitely told us a lot about her experience in school. So I would say, I mean, she may have been giving us a slightly biased account, but it sounded terrible. But no, I think that when I was a little older, I did start to feel left out. And part of that was probably because I was doing so much reading. I would read nonfiction books, but lots of fiction. And most mm-hmm. fiction books for kids are not about homeschooling kids.
Right.
So I was always reading about kids who went to school, and that's where their friends came from. And it just seemed exciting to me socially. And so I did start to feel, a sense of like fear of missing out, I guess.
So what kinds of conversations would happen from there about that feeling? And what did you do about that?
Well, my mom was totally supportive of me trying it out if I wanted to, but it never really came to that. So I was open with her about it, and we would talk about it, and she would say, well, you could try going for half days or something like that. And I think I just never really felt the push until one of my fellow unschooling friends, when I was 12, she decided that she wanted to go to the first year of high school, which for where we lived was called grade 8. So yeah, the 8th grade was basically the beginning of high school. And because she was my best friend and she was doing it, I wanted to give it a try. So I went for basically like, I think it was, I did grade 8. And then I think I started doing grade 9 and I was kind of over it.
What made you feel over it? What could you describe what that feeling might have been like?
I think that I felt like it was a bit of a waste of time. I think that it was really, I'm glad that I did that year in a bit of school, because that's when I made a few of my friends who are my best friends, like now in my 30s, it was a great opportunity to make some friends, and some friends that I could see easily where I didn't have to hitchhike or something to get to their farm. So I think that part of it, my needs were met, but it was also tough. I mean, the thing about unschooling and homeschooling is that it's pretty fine to be like nerdy. it's not embarrassing to be excited about things and to like things. And when I was when I did grade 8, for one thing, I was younger than the other kids because my friend was a year older than me and I wanted to be in the same grade as her. Mm-hmm. And when my mom took me to the high school, they didn't really care. They were like, sure, she can come in. So I was a little bit younger. And then I was also just very, I would see no problem with wanting to answer questions in class or get really involved. And I was just new to the whole sort of social dynamics. I think also a lot of it was quite gendered. So I don't know how much has changed since my childhood, but I would say that within the sort of friend group that I fell into, there was sometimes very explicitly pushback against girls showboating, basically. Mm-hmm. So I think that the fact that I was very sort of self-confident and putting my hand up all the time and not realizing that, oh, it's good to be modest or it's good to be quiet. things like that. Just if I found it very difficult to navigate.
It sounds like you didn't want to reduce yourself down to, I guess, for a lack of better phrases, like to be a dumb girl. Like, I don't know, I'm so silly.
Yeah. So my parents, I'm really grateful. My parents are both staunch feminists, and I think that they definitely encouraged that in me. But at the time, I think that if I knew how to be that way, I would have done it, because I didn't like this like animosity. It wasn't from people that I were like, it wasn't from the people who I'm friends with now. It was just the sort of the ecosystem of the kids that I was with. So they weren't close friends of mine, but like I could sense the tension and the conflict with that. And I think that at the time I wanted social cohesion. I just didn't know how, because I was used to this very sort of like open, like I said, nerdy community where it's fine to be that way and to be really keen and you're not really worried about looking cool. And to be sort of thrown into that, having had no experience at all in those kinds of dynamics, was tough. It definitely was tough. And I'm not sure, like, if I had a child who was in a similar position or who was considering that, like, I'm not really sure what I would do, because I think it's really problematic to be like, oh, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, or oh, you learned from these things. Like, I think that's just, that's not, it's like, I feel like somebody maybe could have taken me aside maybe and been like, here's what's going on.
So do you think you weren't aware, like just, it didn't occur to you that, like you had this feminist lens on how to, like, you were strong and self-confident in yourself, but you didn't have the awareness of like the game that everybody else was playing?
Maybe. I think that it's hard to say how much was homeschooling or how much was my parents' politics, and also just how much is me, because my brother is autistic and I do not research autism personally as a neuroscientist, but I have worked with people who do. Mm-hmm. So my awareness of autism now is much more than it was obviously 10 years ago, let alone as a child. And I know that I also sort of I naturally score like, I'm not autistic, but I have high autistic traits in some ways. And I think that when you are homeschooling or are unlearning, then that's fine.
Yeah.
That's a totally fine way to be. And I, there's probably a lot of, I would say that, I mean, in my friend group, there was great neurodiversity. And so it wasn't something I had ever come up against being a problem until suddenly I was 12 and I was trying to understand, why am I pissing people off? I don't understand why. I don't know what I said wrong. Or, I mean, this is something that like continues to be something that I think we can all grow and work on how to make other people feel good about themselves, you know, and how to do small talk and how to be a good listener. Like that's just important for everybody, I think. But for me, like I just never experienced that kind of tension, because it was fine if you didn't want to make small talk as a homeschooler, or and there wasn't any problem with having with like being really into stuff.
Yeah, like you don't have to when you're choosing to learn from home or in your community or alternatively from the school system, there's like this, especially I think with neurodivergent young people, we don't have to alter or accommodate things. You're just meeting the person where they're at. Like you just are what you are, and you're not trying to fit, you know, a square peg in a circle hole kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah. So I guess when you go into a system like that and you don't realize that everyone is conforming into the circle hole, or maybe is it circle hole in a square peg? I don't know what the term is. Now I'm wondering if that's even the right wording, but trying to say is the conformity that's expected in school, everyone just sort of like as a big social group, I guess, figures out what the norm is, and then everyone like adjusts to meet that norm. Whereas like when you're out of school, everyone's just their own normal, like, and you can't accept it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think there are so few places in sort of quote real life where you have this weird extreme concentration of people, especially all at the same age, because that's the other thing that I think is really lovely about my experience, at least, of unschooling, was that I had friends who were younger than me and friends who were older than me. And I think that it just sort of naturally encourages, maybe not nonconformity is the word, but like there, you just have much more freedom to be different, because people are coming from different walks of life. They're coming from, they're in different stages of development potentially, and that's cool. And I think that there's much more room to breathe, I think, when you don't have this extreme sort of like everybody is sitting in a classroom and everyone is the same age and everyone goes to gym class and has to show off in gym class or that kind of a thing.
I totally agree. I actually was just sharing with a parent recently who was thinking about all of the things that we're talking about right now. And just like, you know, maybe school would be better to prepare so-and-so for life. And I sort of posed this this thought and just like was like, what do you think about this? Where else do you look around in society, even in college, where else do you look and see spaces where people are with 22 to 30 of their exact age peers? Nowhere. Like it just doesn't exist anywhere besides school.
It's like an assembly line for humans.
Yeah.
Where you want absolute standardization, and that's just like not really how people work.
No, which is why it's so funny to me that people say school is what prepares you for real life, when you think like this is not mimicked anywhere in society. Even at the college level, you're in mixed age courses with people of all ages, sometimes adult, like further along adults, learners, and young adults. It really isn't even like that in college. So I just think it's so strange that we often fall back on that as people to say that that's what would prepare us for life.
Yeah. And my experience, I mean, I think it probably depends on what university you go to. But for me, like university in some ways is much more like self-directed homeschooling than the public mm-hmm. school system anyways, because there's much more onus on students to do their own thinking, to put it really bluntly. There's much more emphasis on developing critical thought and your research skills and questioning things and choosing topics that interest you. Like, I mean, obviously that grows and grows in, especially as you, if you go to graduate school, then it's all about that. Right. Graduate school, especially if you're in Europe, where you don't have the first sort of foundation years like you might in Canada or the States, it's all self-directed. So I think if anything, when I started my undergraduate education, I was lucky to have had experience as a homeschooler, just sort of wondering about things and asking my own questions and doing things because they were interesting. Because in some ways, that's what will really help you succeed in an undergraduate degree.
Yeah, I don't know how it is, how universities are outside of the United States, but the idea that like anyone's going to push you in your college coursework to do the thing, they don't really care because you've already paid for the course. And if you fail it, you'll just pay to take it again. Like it's just no one's going to be there to push you along. You may get a syllabus that you know, reminds you of the things. And if you're lucky, maybe your professor or your online Blackboard will send you reminders or tell you that there's something that's coming up. But for the most part, you're on your own. You do it or yes. You don't do it.
Absolutely. You're on your own, and you're also expected, I think. I mean, you can show up and sort of like, it depends on your degree as well. Like I wouldn't say that this is going to be true for an engineering degree, for example, because engineering degrees are really much more exam based and standardized. But I mean, if you're taking any kind of arts and humanities courses, you won't do really well unless you are interested and unless you're sort of doing that extra thinking and extra questioning. If you just sort of try to regurgitate whatever the teachers handed you, you're not really actually meeting the requirements of those courses, because you're probably not going to be able to construct an essay, for example. And it's so in some ways, I mean, I think that if anything, at least from my experience of Canadian high school and a Canadian undergraduate education at university, if anything, it not only does the public schooling system not necessarily set you up for university, it actually kind of is a bit misleading in a way, because unless you're doing like a something like an engineering degree where it really is about learning the formulas and remembering them for the exam, which won't help you if you go onwards to do research or graduate school. But at least in the context of an undergrad, that's like one of the few places I think where you can get away with just kind of like memorizing things and spitting them out for the test and moving on.
Yeah, I don't know that high school prepares young people for that. My recollection is that we were not taught how to write robust essays. We were not taught how to take really good notes and be critical of the information and ask questions. It really was a lot like you're describing, just this is the information, remember it, quiz on Friday.
Totally. Yeah, or sort of like, if it's a class that you can't really do that with, like English, for example. I mean, they do, obviously, like I had to do when I decided to do my high school diploma via correspondence, I had to do like the standardized English exam or whatever. I mean, I hated them because they would ask questions like, what does this mean? And there would always be like multiple interpretations, but they had one answer in mind. But I remember that like I did pretty well in my English classes, and I had such a rude awakening when I first set foot in a university English class, because we all had to do English in our first year. And I just remember that, like, I think that the reason why I did quite well in English was partly just because I would use fancy words. Because it's like you said, we definitely didn't learn how to build an essay. We definitely didn't learn how to structure anything, or how to manage flow or anything. I think I would just kind of use a thesaurus.
Yeah, just
check
it out.
Yeah.
So how would you say you prepared for those correspondence exams to graduate high school?
So again, I got lucky with the school district. This time it was our local school district. So they started, I can't remember what, I think it might even be called Learn at Home, the program. I don't know if it's still running in the same, under the same guise, but it was basically the local high school had some teachers who were the instructors, but they had their own office in a sort of separate wing of the local high school. So I would go there and chat with a teacher. This might sound like not petty, but sort of inconsequential, but like these teachers introduced themselves to me by their first name. Okay. Which I think is really, like, it might seem like nothing, but it's a big gesture. That I didn't have to
then. Hi, I'm Mrs. Richards.
Exactly. And I remember one time I had to go talk to the principal of this program, but they shared their administrators with the public high school that was in the same building. And I went and I talked to one of the administrators, and I asked her if I could talk to, his name is Patrick. And I said, can I talk to Patrick, please? And she like stared at me and she's like, you mean Mr. and then his last name. So that was a great program because I think that's what I'm trying to impart with that anecdote, is that they were very happy to work outside of the sort of traditional hierarchy or the traditional sort of expectations of the typical school system. So basically the way that they looked at it was, well, the province has a curriculum, and every high school in this province has to meet these requirements. So what can we do to give you a project or whatever assignments that would meet these requirements? And they were on my side. So for example, I got to sort of like make my own course for, I think it was like Earth Sciences 12. So like a grade 12 geology class. I basically like, again, went to the library and took out some books on geology and ended up like writing reports or essays, or I'm not even really sure what I did. But anyways, the point is that the teachers were, although they were teachers and although they were employed by the government and by the public school system, they were really wonderful with working with me in a very unschooler friendly way.
That's awesome. That's really awesome.
Yeah, it's very progressive. I don't know how common that is across Canada, whether I was just really lucky that that was happening at my local high school. Because at the time, I think it was pretty unique. I would really hope that there was more going on like that, because I know that there were some of the other people who were involved in it, like some of them were homeschoolers, but I think some of them were people that had special needs or mm-hmm. non-traditional backgrounds, and being in school just wouldn't work for them. So yeah, I was really happy that it existed for me. And I hope that there are similar programs cropping up across North America, at least.
Yeah. You know, that's actually a conversation that's been happening I run an unschooling community online through Discord, and there's families from all over the world who are in this community space where they bounce ideas off of each other, ask questions, talk about their fears, look for advice, just look for, you know, emotional support around this decision that they've made, and sometimes are questioning the decision or what paths there might be to getting, you know, either graduating or getting into school at some point. And I think this is something that's really great to encourage people to reach out to whoever, like whatever districts they're in, and just put some feelers out and find out what kind of administrations you have in your local school systems and see what kind of partnering they're willing to do. Because if we assume that they're not willing to do anything, then we may never try. But if we just reach out and say, hey, what kinds of things might you offer for equivalency, or what kind of programs might there be? You know, you never know what you might come up with. And you are not the first person from Canada who's actually shared something very similar about doing alternative things through like sort of a branch of the local school system. So I think it's really encouraging to hear.
Yeah, I'm so happy to hear that I'm not the first person. I mean, it's a great, again, like I mentioned, it's good for homeschoolers, but it's good for lots of people who don't really, who aren't going to fit into the regular schooling mold. And I think even if there isn't anything, if people are reaching out to their local school districts and that kind of a thing, then at least you're letting them know that there's appetite for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're the type of parent or caregiver who's really into being, you know, being the first person to get something like that going, or you're like a real self-starter and you're like, hey, I would love for a program like this to exist. How can I help make it come to life? I'm talking about myself right now. I'm totally that kind of person. I see that there's a need for a thing because I need it. How can I make it happen for other people?
The world needs people like you. Definitely. I think, and I mean, I don't, again, this will depend on what kind of a country you live in and how basically like how rich it is and that kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. But I mean, for the way that the school system work where I'm from, I mean, they get more funding if they get more students, right? So it's in everybody's interest if they're going to get extra money from the government to support the teaching of these non-traditional students, then everybody's winning. But that's in Canada. So I don't know how that's going to fly in other parts of the world.
Yeah, I'm not sure everywhere in the world, but I do know I can speak for my section of the United States where I'm from. And I'm from Austin, Texas, and it's not necessarily, it's not that it's homeschooler unfriendly, because Texas is the kind of state that's like, if you choose to educate your children at home, then you operate as a private school. Like, there's no red tape. There's no, you need to perform this amount of testing, or you need to show proof of competency every so many years or whatever. They really do just give you the complete and total privacy to do whatever you want. But I think from my experience, it also means you're kind of on your own. So, but if there's, I mean, you never know until you ask, you know, you never know until you reach out to an administration and say, hey, I have a child who's been learning unconventionally and they would like to test out the mainstream option. And I do think it's all about wording. I think if you use words like unschooling, it may not be as well received.
It might raise some red flags.
Yeah, changing the language a little bit, like non-traditional learning, learning from home, based on their interest or self-direction. Like, there's other ways, I think, to word it, to say that you haven't been doing things conventionally, but that maybe your child is interested in now doing the conventional model of schooling, and you'd like to make that transition as easy as possible, and that you're your child's partner, and you'd like to know how you can be the partner with that particular school. And I don't know, I want to just hope that people are willing to hear that and help, but I know that that's probably not always true.
yeah, I hope it's going in that direction, but I mean, so I ran into that a little bit when I was, so one of the other benefits of this non-traditional way that I got my high school diploma was that they allowed me to take classes at the local university for credit. Mm-hmm. And so I needed to get instructor's permission. And I, at the time, I had done an exchange trip in high school age. I mean, I was not in high school when I did it, but it was like a high school exchange trip. So I had spent a year away. And when I came back, I was really interested in doing the local, it was like a sort of like international relations kind of program that they had at my local university. And it was basically an interdisciplinary undergrad major that had a bit of history and a bit of sociology and geography and stuff like that. So I was like, oh, this looks really cool. So I went to go talk to the chair of that program. And I wanted to ask her if I could take one of the classes in the program to meet my high school requirements. And she said, no, I went with my mom. And my mom was trying to explain to her. I was like 17 at that point, I think, or 16 or 17. And she was explaining that I'd been homeschooled, and the chair, she was also European. So homeschooling is not as common in parts of Europe as it is in Canada. So she probably hadn't necessarily encountered many homeschoolers before me. Mm-hmm. But she basically, like, quite bluntly said, I don't know if she's capable of abstract thought.
Oh.
So I was disappointed, but that was one of like the most sort of blatant, like, door slam in your face kind of experiences, at least from like a homeschooling perspective, that I had had. So yeah, I don't know whether we could have worded it differently. I think she was just pretty scandalized by the idea that I hadn't gone to high school or whatever. She may have been judging my mom, I don't know. Yeah. But I mean, it worked out. From in hindsight, I'm totally fine that it went that way, because what I ended up taking instead was a linguistics class. That was my second choice, was a linguistics class. And that instructor, the professor, was happy to have me. And I ended up really enjoying linguistics. And although I didn't end up doing linguistics as a major, I certainly think that my interest in linguistics is related to why I ended up going into cognitive neuroscience, because obviously if you're studying the way language works, you're kind of studying how the mind works. And I got really excited about linguistics when I took that linguistics class. So maybe if the global studies professor had let me in, I would be somewhere totally different now. But I mean, I'm happy it went the way it went, but at the time it was discouraging.
I can see that. I think it's really good to speak to that as a possibility too. I know I've spoken with a couple of parents. One's kind of standing out in my mind that shared something similar, although it was still at for high school courses, and putting their child into high school, and they basically said they were immovable in their stance that, you know, these were the requirements. If your child couldn't do this, then they couldn't be in that grade. And there was just literally no way around it. And sometimes people are met with those really hard stances and almost brick walls, you know, that are not willing to, they're not willing to work with you in your particular situation.
Yeah, it's so disappointing. I mean, at the time I was really disappointed and a little bit like insulted about the abstract thought thing.
Yeah.
It was she's very forward about it. And I mean, and I ran into like it's not the only time that's happened, because I mean, so as I mentioned at the beginning, I'm a scientist now. I work in cognitive neuroscience, but I actually did my undergraduate in music. I did a music degree. And when I decided that I wanted to get into cognitive neuroscience and I was trying to apply to graduate school, some of the universities I applied to didn't mind that I had a music undergraduate degree, but some universities just told me no, like they wouldn't even look at my, they wouldn't accept my application because I didn't have a Bachelor of Science. And every time it's been disappointing, it's felt like, okay, well, what now? But again, having gone through these experiences, and even more so now being on the other side, the side that is looking at students' applications myself, I know that like there, you just have to try somewhere else.
Yeah.
You might get some no's. People might think you're a little unorthodox and not be sure. And then other people will be fine with it. They'll be like, they won't blink. They'll be like, okay, great. I've had music students before, or I've had people with a degree in art history or something else who wanted to switch to a STEM subject. And like they're out there. It doesn't mean that it's not frustrating or a waste of time and potentially money to go through these experiences, but it's definitely not, it's not about you, and there will be somebody else out there or some other program or some other way to get with you where you want to go.
So you've mentioned a couple of times about being a neuroscientist. Why don't you walk us through how this played out? Like, when did you get a somewhat clear vision of what you wanted to do with your adult life and start pursuing neuroscience as your field of study?
Sure. Yeah. So I have to say it was really circuitous for me. I always liked science, but again, I think because this is the sort of double-edged sword of homeschooling, I kind of was into everything. And a lot of people, when they do regular high school, you get sort of, you have to choose a lot of the time. So like you might have to sort of focus on science and math or like history and English or something like that. And I didn't really need to do that as a homeschooler. I could just kind of do whatever I was interested in. And so I had always liked science, but I wasn't really sure if I wanted to commit to that. And I had been studying music as a, like throughout my childhood, and I loved playing music. And I don't know where she, I mean, she was right. And there were times in my early 20s where I was like, damn you, mom, for this advice, because what she told me, and I mean, like, I don't know where she even got this from, or, but anyways, she was like, yeah, if you just do really well in your undergrad, then you could probably do something different afterwards. So do something you enjoy for your undergrad, which is like such unschooler mom advice. And I was like, okay, I'll do a music degree. So I did a music degree, and I played jazz. I played guitar in the music degree, and I had a great time, and it was really fun. Music was, I mean, it's like such a cliche, but music was my life. All my friends were my fellow music students, and I really enjoyed it. And then I graduated, and I was like, okay, what now? I mean, I had some friends who were doing or trying to do the sort of like professional musician thing. And it's a tough go, even if you're tremendously talented and committed. It's just, it can be a grind. So anyways, I wasn't really sure what I was doing, and I got a job working at a music school, but like in the office, and I did not enjoy that. And I was just like, okay, what now? And then that's when I was mad at my mom for her unschooler advice. Cause I was like, I have this music degree. My friends who have degrees in things like dentistry or whatever, like they can move on. And I am working for just over minimum wage answering the phone. But basically I had always remembered that I really enjoyed that linguistics class that I had taken that I mentioned earlier. And I remembered that when I was learning, because I was studying jazz at university, for those who aren't maybe as familiar with jazz, there's a, like the jazz is improvisational. So it doesn't mean that when people are playing a solo in jazz, it doesn't mean that they're just kind of like making it up like on the spot, like from thin air. A big part of learning to be a jazz musician is it's really similar to learning a language. So you have to work on your technique on the instrument, but you also do things like you learn vocabulary, and jazz has a grammar the way language has a grammar. And I just remember, because I had done my exchange trip it was the Netherlands, and because I had been trying to learn Dutch during my exchange trip, I had had recent experience with learning a second language. And I was really struck by how similar it was to learning to play an improvised jazz. So I had this like thought at the back of my head, like, well, I really like science, and I And I'm interested in this relationship or this correspondence between what I did in music school and what I did when I was learning a second language. And there must be something to that. So basically I had started just emailing people again, I think totally from my unschooling background, my first impulse is like, well, there must be something out there. I'll just ask them. I didn't really worry too much about harassing random professors on the internet. I just kind of went for it. I feel like it needs to be said that like many people did not write me back. Fair enough. But one person did, and they said, oh, you should get in touch with this person. And my partner, he was planning to go to graduate school at that point because he knew what he was doing with his life. And I didn't have a plan except that I hated my job. And luckily, this person that it was suggested that I should get in touch with, she was a neuroscientist who had a lab close to where my partner was going to go for graduate school. So I contacted her, and she was really friendly and welcoming and didn't mind that I didn't have any science experience. I think she just responded to the fact that I was really curious and interested. And so basically, my partner was doing his grad school. I was teaching music. I was working part-time at the local library. And then I was volunteering as a research assistant for this person in her lab. So basically, she is a cognitive neuroscientist who studies music and the brain. And it was a really great way to get hands-on experience. I learned about different techniques that neuroscientists use to try to understand people's behavior and what's going on in their brain while they're doing things. Because I had my background in music, it worked out really well in terms of being able to sort of jump in. I didn't know anything about brain science really, or biology, or statistics, or any of the things that as a scientist now I need to know about. But I had a point of entry. So that was kind of how I got my foot in the door. And then this person that I was working for, she was American, but she had done her PhD at Cambridge University in England. And she knew about somebody who is really an ethnomusicologist. So he studies music across different cultures and in the context of different cultures. And he was based at Cambridge, and he was quite well regarded in the field of what we can kind of call music science. So basically just using scientific methods and asking scientific questions within the context of music and music across the world's cultures. And so she thought, well, you don't have a science undergraduate degree, but he's kind of like himself, he sort of straddles both worlds. So that might be a good place to go to study this kind of interdisciplinary area. So yeah, I applied to that, and I got really lucky, and I got money to go. So we moved to England, and I ended up doing a master's degree at Cambridge. Technically I was located in the music department there, but I was doing this sort of music and science interdisciplinary program. And then at that point, because I had done an actual, like part of my master's degree was I had to do a self-directed project, which was a scientific experiment. I had enough evidence that I could go to PhD programs and say, okay, I don't have a Bachelor of Science, but look, I've done this other stuff. And again, there were definitely places out there who probably would have been like, nope, not good enough. But luckily for me, University College London, which is where I was hoping to go, they didn't mind. And my supervisor at UCL didn't mind. She said, music, great. I love music. Like, come aboard. So yeah, they let me into a cognitive neuroscience PhD.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And I think, and I remember that, like, I was very, like, I think telling the story now, it seems quite smooth. But I, like, throughout my early 20s, like, basically from the time I finished my music degree through to when I finally started applying to go back to school, to go to graduate school, I was very stressed and very worried and very unsure of what I was doing. And I think that if I had reached out to a sort of like your typical or your stereotype of a high school guidance counselor, and if I had asked them, I would like to be a cognitive neuroscientist, what should I do? I mean, in no terms would they say, do a music degree,
right.
See where it leads. Like, that's just not, that is not what they would recommend I do, but it has worked for me. And it's something I think about a lot because I did feel so, I was questioning, I did feel so uncertain. And I definitely had adults in my life who probably were like not my mom, but others who wondered whether this was the right choice for my future and whether I was kind of writing myself into a corner by doing this very quote unquote useless degree. Mm. But yeah, it's if with the right persistence and some luck, but I think that if the situation isn't so dire that like, I think that if it hadn't worked out at UCL, I would have found somebody else who would take me on.
You sound like you were and are still maybe very determined to get what it is that you're looking for, even if you're not quite sure what you're looking for.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I was always very career oriented. And so on some level, it might have been a sort of positive drive thing, but I won't lie. I mean, I think I was also a lot of it was anxiety. So I think it's hard not to feel a sense of anxiety about your future, whether it's from the perspective of a career or whether it's more kind of just basic economic worries.
Yeah.
I definitely felt a lot of pressure to figure it out, even though that wasn't necessarily coming from my parents. Like, it was coming from me, but I felt it very acutely.
Yeah, it's so great to hear how it all played out so unconventionally and beautifully, but that you can also speak to like the really raw parts of it that were challenging and even just to speak to that level of anxiety of the looming pressure of like being a young adult and like we're supposed to know what to do.
Yeah, but I mean, I didn't even know, like, it's funny, I don't really research. I do a little bit of research into music specifically now, but I would say I'm much more actually, these days I research speech perception and how we speak and what's going on in our brains when we listen to somebody else speak. And like, I didn't even realize that you could do this when I was 18 or 17 or whatever it was that I was thinking about what I wanted to do in university. Yeah. So there's no way I could have known, like, oh, have you ever thought about being a cognitive neuroscientist who studies speech or hearing or something like that? Mm. Like, it wasn't even on my radar. So how could I, I had to do a lot of living and get experience outside of university and mull over what was appealing to me.
Yeah, you know, as a young person, you don't know what you don't know, but then there's also, you don't know what is even possible when sometimes, like, you may be the very first person to sort of pilot a program or a crossover of, you know, one area of study to another area of study, and then they, like, sort of converge into this new thing. And I mean, when you're taking the unconventional path, there's like so many possibilities that can be true for you.
Yes.
that maybe wouldn't have existed for anybody else but you. Not to make that sound so hyper individualistic, like you can just invent your own thing, but you kind of can.
You can, and also, I mean, the path also invents you, right? Like, I mean, I think that I'm I'm pleased with how it's going. I really enjoy what I do. I think that I'm really lucky to have the job I have in many ways, although it isn't easy in others. But on the other hand, I mean, what if that person who told me I couldn't take her class because of the abstract thought thing? I mean, yeah. If maybe she might have let me in and I might have had a great time, and maybe I would be doing something totally different, and then I would be like grateful that it worked out that way too. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, I think it's nice in a way if it can release you from the sense of like, what is my fate? Like, what is my destiny? If you can have multiple good outcomes.
Yeah, if multiple things can be true at one time in people's actual lived experiences, like we were talking about before with your folks and yourself, if multiple things can be true, then like multiple possibilities can be true. It doesn't necessarily mean that like this was the only way that would have worked out for you. Many of other things could have possibly worked out for you.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's just so important to keep in mind when you are feeling really lost and really worried. Because I know from my experience, I just felt like I was constantly questioning, like, did I screw myself over? Did I screw myself over? Yeah. And I mean, in most situations, that's not going to be true. And even when I think about doing my music degree, I mean, doing a music degree, it prepares you for grad school in so many ways, in the sense that like music students have to spend a lot of time by themselves practicing and self-critiquing. And when you go to music school, you do lots of group work, but you also have to show leadership. There are classes in history, but there are classes in music theory, which in its own way is very mathematical. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that like, no matter what you end up doing, it's not really the content or what you're studying. It's that you're learning how to learn and how to research and how to think critically. And these things are like, that's what really counts, especially if you are interested in potentially going to grad school or something like that. And I know for myself that when I get inquiries from students who are interested in these kinds of things, like, I don't really care about their grades or where they went. Like, I'm interested in why they're interested.
Right. Like the material of the person, the drive of the person, what they can bring as a person rather than what the paper says.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that it's not going to be, again, you're like, especially for somebody who has like the sort of non-traditional backgrounds that we have, like, you're not always going to find somebody who's willing to be that open-minded or give you the benefit of the doubt, but they're out there.
Definitely. And I think maybe a growing number of people are out there. It's surely progressing more and more.
Well,
there's been plenty of articles written about, you know, even Ivy League schools looking for out of the box thinkers, quote unquote, and taking in more non-traditional schooled kids. So
yes, yeah. And sometimes it can be to your advantage in a way. Like, for example, when I got my scholarship to go over to Cambridge, I happened to be at this event thing where I could talk to somebody who turned out that they were on the selection committee. And he was very sort of matter of fact, like, oh yeah, everybody who applied, like, they had good grades, they did community services. But the reason why they picked me for the money was because I was frank in my personal statement. And I said that I have this really odd background and there's this program at Cambridge that is unique and is actually really well suited to my very odd interdisciplinary background. And it's like the only place I can go.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, well, that they were like, okay, we'll give her the money, cause I guess like the other kids can go to whatever.
Yeah. Like, they could go anywhere.
Yeah, they're probably doing great, whereas this person has this really odd background, and so if it doesn't work out here, then I don't know what she's gonna do. So yeah, I didn't really have any, like, I didn't have a strong backup plan, so I'm very grateful that they took pity on my weird interdisciplinary background.
I really appreciate you sharing all of this. This is really fantastic. I think from a parent perspective, parents, we worry a ton. I get it. I worry. I think it's natural to worry. You spoke to your own concerns and worries as a young person and as a student. So it's natural for us to, I think, even just be fearful that we won't, quote, make it, or have, you know, what we need to get by or have something that's fulfilling. I mean, I know you spoke about that job and it was not much more than minimum wage. So maybe that wasn't going to really pay the bills for long-term anyway, if you decided to stay there. But I guess what I'm trying to say is we don't want to, like, let that fear and worry and, like, the ghosts of regrets and our parents' school wounds or even our school wounds be the thing to direct the way, you know. We want to just move with in the moment and just chase after it, as cliche as that probably sounds.
Yeah, it's scary. I mean, and that it is, it just is. I wish that I didn't have to have had so much anxiety about what I was going to do. And like, I alluded to this, like, it's not as though, I don't think any job these days is a sure thing. I mean, maybe if you work in healthcare, or in, like, fossil fuels or something like that, then maybe you can be sort of sure of making at least short-term money. But I mean, it's not as though I would be lying if I said I didn't have some sense of anxiety, even about, like, well, right now I'm a postdoctoral scientist. So it means that I have my PhD, but I've still sort of got the training wheels on, right? I don't have a tenure track job. So this is always going to be something. But I mean, I think that if one thing that has allowed me to enjoy my research career so far is the fact that I have had this very, like, not recommended career path. And by not recommended, I just mean, like, going back to the idea of a guidance counselor, like, nobody right. would be like, no one would be like, this is what you should do. Like, this, yeah. this will get you in the door. 'Cause I completely did not do that. And yet I've managed to get myself this far. So I don't know. I think that all is not known. And like you said, like, there's what you know you don't know, and then there's what you don't know, or something yeah. like that. Like, it's I think it you do on some level have to allow yourself to be scared and to feel the fear and to trust and just try anyways.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice.
It's not fun, but no.
It's certainly not passive yeah. in the pursuits either. I think you're not like, you're not just kind of like along for the ride and like, well, just wherever the wind blows me. Like, it takes some grit and some fear and some yeah, probably and stagnant times.
And there's nothing like having a really, really terrible job to make you
to motivate.
I mean, I've done all sorts of things. I worked for like a house painting company, and I quit because like I couldn't handle, it was like a small family business, and like they were super offensive and like racist, and I couldn't handle that. And I quit that job. And then I started, like, I lasted one shift as like a server, and then I eventually found this job working at the music school. But I had a sort of like almost like storybook boss from hell who was just terrifying. And I mean, it was probably at that point, after having been out of school for a couple of years, where I was like, okay, I need a plan.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, when you're in those jobs, when young people are in those jobs, I find like there's this tendency of a lot of adults, especially of the of the much older variety than probably you and I were like, oh, you can't wait tables for the rest of your life. You can't answer phones for the rest of your life. Like, no one's really saying that we want to wait tables or answer phones for the rest of our lives. It's possible that we may have to do that for a very long period of time. But like, I don't know that we should allow like these older generations of people to place that on us, like, because we're doing it in this moment, that means I'm committed to doing this forever. And young people, whether they're on an academic path or a non-academic path, like, just need time to figure it out, to experience life, to sometimes have really bad experiences and be like, well, I definitely know I don't want to do that, so I'm going to change directions and go this way. And I just think to any adults that are listening of that variety, like, give young people some space.
Yeah, it takes time. It takes a lot of time to figure yourself out. And there are people, I know people who have definitely gone through and done everything, ticked the boxes, got a job, got a useful degree, and then decided, actually, I hate this.
Yeah.
And have a career transition in their 30s or 40s and beyond. And that's cool too.
Yeah. I know many people sitting around with master's degrees, in fact, who are actually currently unemployed. And just raising a couple of children because that's what's happening in their life right now. But I don't know that it's deserving of people's critique of like having wasted a degree or getting something that wasn't useful, et cetera. Like, we're all just living human beings trying to find our path.
Yes. And I should say too, that, I mean, I've been talking a lot about graduate school and academia and going to university, but I'm completely in favor of people not doing that. I think that the neoliberalization of the university system and the way that students are increasingly treated like customers is really bad. It incentivizes the wrong things. And if people don't feel like university is for them, and it's not because they don't see themselves there, like because of a lack of representation or something like that, but it's more just that they know that they don't want to go that way, then that needs to be encouraged. And accommodated as well. And yeah. I mean, I guess I would say too, like, I mean, like, to the sort of like, yeah, the stereotypical, like, you don't want to serve tables for the rest of your life. I mean, I have to like wonder, like, what makes you treat servers that way?
Right.
You know, like, maybe we should actually make serving be a decent job that you can raise your kids and pay your bills. You know what I mean? Like,
get a round of applause for that, please. Living wages for actual labor. There is no such thing as like useless labor. Like, everybody's time is worth a living wage.
Yeah. Like, to the whole sort of like, and I mean, I would say like, I definitely felt this pressure of sort of like climb some ladder, but in order for there to be a ladder that exists, that means there has to be people at the bottom of the ladder. And like, we don't need that.
Right. Right. I think it's definitely easy to get mixed up in that thought process when we think about like what we want to do for the rest of our lives. There's absolutely nothing wrong with anybody choosing any form of work. And I think everyone should be paid an adequate living wage to be able to survive, because every job is needed. Otherwise they wouldn't have those jobs.
Totally. And I mean, although I, like I said, I really enjoy what I do. And I think that I hope I can keep doing it. I mean, but on the other hand, work is just work too. So that's something else. Like, I also don't believe in the sort of like, if you love what you do, you'll never work. Like, that's not.
No.
work is work. But anyways, I just wanted to say that too, because I know that because of my own experience, I'm really centering academia and grad school, and there's tons to critique about that world. Absolutely. So I don't want to imply that this is like the way, but I would say that there are aspects of unschooling that can prepare people really well for careers in research. So it's just something to think about if you happen to want to go that way, and if you are in the position to be able to pursue that.
Yeah, I appreciate you adding that little caveat. I think that's important. And perhaps something for another conversation to critique a bit more. And I also have to say that I feel inclined to say I want to interview your mother. I would love to talk to somebody who did this in the 90s. So if she's ever interested, have her give me a shout.
Yeah, I'm sure she would be. Yeah, I don't know if she knows what podcasts are, but.
Well, before I let you go, do you want people to be able to find you, to find your work, or to be able to connect with you and ask questions if they have any questions come up for them?
Absolutely. I'm very happy to chat with anybody who's interested in going to university, whether that means just getting into like an undergraduate degree or whether they're thinking further down the line. You can find me at my personal science website, which is just admcintyre.com. So it's like my name, Alexis Dayton McIntyre. It's admcintyre.com. And my contact information is there. And I also have some summaries about if you're interested in cognitive neuroscience or you want to learn a little bit more about the kind of science that I do. I have some summaries and some sort of more layperson directed information about my research on that website as well. But yeah, you can get in touch with me. There's like a contact form, or I think my email address is there too.
Perfect. I'll put that, I'll link that into the description of the episode too, for folks to be able to just click.
Perfect.
Thank you so much, Alexis, for spending this time with me. This is such a good conversation. This time has passed so fast and I feel like I could ask a million more questions, but just to try to keep it under a certain amount of time so people can listen, I'll have to let you go for this time, but maybe we can chat again, and I appreciate you again.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah. Okay, well, you take care, okay? We'll talk soon.
Okay, you too. Bye. Bye.
Woo, that was a long one. How's that for a comeback? Thanks, Alexis, for joining me, and thank you so much for listening to this entire episode. You can find links to connect with Alexis in the description of this episode, and links to my website where you will find all the issues of the zine and some new merchandise that supports young artists and a little bit of Unschool Files flair, and a link to the community Discord server just in case you're looking for support around your unschooling journey. I am so grateful for you and all the support. This podcast and zine is not a money-making business, simply a labor of love, and I print the zine at cost. So if you'd like to drop some funds in to help support my work, I'm always willing to accept a cup of coffee or a few extra bucks towards your zine purchase to keep this all going and sustainable. I'm sending you and yours much love, and until next time, stay kind to each other.